Okay, you got the head of it down this one, so.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Maren D. Benedetti, counsel for appellants Dean Buchanan and Sheila McLean. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Buchanan respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court and remand the case for trial. This case involves claims for quiet title, breach of contract, trespass, and ejectment on one hand by Buchanan, and adverse possession and boundary by acquiescence on the other hand by the Grays. All claims are predicated on a disputed area between the two properties. A good representation of the disputed area is included in appellant's brief at 9, as are a timeline of the key facts in this case.
Okay. With regard to the timeline,
yes,
it wasn't clear to me, and maybe I just didn't read it close enough. When did the 10-year period start, and when did the 10-year period end?
The Grays allege that they rolled out fencing in 1992 or 1993 when they built the house. So they allege that the 10-year period had run by 2003. Mr. Taper, from whom Buchanan purchased the property, died in 2007. He was very elderly. So they allege that all the acts, essentially, that constitute adverse possession predate Mr. Taper's death.
If they are right, and I'm not, you know, that's, if they are right, then title would have passed to them before any of the events at issue in the appeal would have occurred, right?
The events that, meaning the Kerman and the two offers to purchase,
exactly, yeah.
That's right, that's correct. Also, the statute of limitations would have run, which we raised to the trial court on reconsideration, but they just ignored, the trial court ignored that. But that's the Riley case, and I'm happy to jump to that if you would like.
Yes.
So in Riley, we have very, very similar facts. The Andresses the Andresses had owned property next to the Galts. The Galts had passed away, the Rileys had owned property next to the Galts, and the Galts had passed away. The Rileys had alleged that they had done all these activities on the property prior to the Galts passing away. And the court said, there was an adverse possession claim. We owned it already. There's nothing you can do about it. You don't have any evidence because the Galts died. The court said, well, wait. There's two issues here. One of which is when the material facts are in the possession of the moving party on summary judgment, the case needs to go to trial because the only way to assess for the non-moving party to challenge this lack of evidence is to cross-examine while testifying at trial, and the demeanor and the credibility of that witness.
So Riley, I thought, was a really interesting case. I mean, one way to read that case is you could never get summary judgment on an adverse possession case, almost.
Well, I disagree. I think you can still get summary judgment, but we have a very specific set of facts here where the Buchanan has no way to test the Gray's facts as to whether they adversely possess the property or not, because James Taper is dead. And that doesn't happen in all the adverse possession cases by any stretch.
But that isn't usually what the remedy would be. The remedy would be just the ability to cross-examine the claimant there, and not the decedent, but to put on other evidence. So it, you don't fail just because the other party's predecessor is deceased.
No, but there should be the opportunity to, because the only evidence the non-moving party would have would be to cross-examine that the adverse possessor at trial so that the fact finder could gauge their credibility and demeanor while testifying. But Riley has another component, too, and that is implicated in this case, and that is this permit and the two offers to compromise that the trial court on reconsideration agreed that those were those three pieces of evidence, the two offers to purchase and the permit, could negate the element of hostility in this case, but for the fact that the trial court decided without anybody arguing it, without anybody briefing it, without anybody bringing it up, that those were inadmissible offers to compromise. And in Riley, Your
when
Honor,
you the when you use the term negate, right. That's kind of concerning, and this has come up a couple of times. Do you mean that those three pieces of evidence could show that the hostile intent changed, or do you mean that those three pieces of evidence could lead to a trier of fact conclusion that the events that the intent was never hostile from its inception?
I'd like to get away from intent because I think that's a Chaplin problem. But I think that the Riley court said that it could be indicative of prior permission. That okay, well, somebody else bought it, so now we need permission to continue to use it. So we'll go ahead and sign this permit, and we'll go ahead. But you know, we kind of want the property anyway, so we'll make two offers to purchase it. Instead of negate, how about undermine? I think that's but it's a factual question that needs to go to trial.
So in your view, you're saying that these two offers and the permit would be relevant on the issue of whether the actions of the parties were truly hostile and how they
that's correct.
Either allowed or didn't allow access to the property.
That's right.
And you're saying that's permitted by the Riley case,
yes.
Basically.
Yes.
What about their argument that Riley wasn't really brought to the court's attention?
Well, there's two cases, a number of cases that says, so first of all, let's look at the posture on summary judgment. The plaintiffs were responding to defendants' cross motion for summary judgment, which raised real property conveyance issues, community property issues, statute of frauds issues, and sort of spent a scant 4 pages on adverse possession at all, which is it's in the record, and just cut and copied some cases and said we win. So plaintiffs were just properly responding to that cross motion. Nevertheless, plaintiffs did make the Riley arguments, and for example, in the record, CP 96, plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, related facts related to the permit, CP 98, plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, the Grays cannot meet the elements required. Specifically, they have no evidence that their use was hostile to Mr. Taper, and they certainly have no evidence that it was hostile to plaintiffs because Mr. Gray signed a limited use permit. CP 55, CP 56, plaintiffs made those arguments, and defendants actually cited Riley in a footnote in their brief. But nevertheless, even if plaintiffs hadn't made those arguments, the court can consider new issues on reconsideration as long as there are no new facts. And even there's some cases that on summary judgment they can actually consider new facts on reconsideration. And that's the Newcomer and August case.
So if we reverse this, it would go back for a trial on all the claims?
That's correct. So with respect to, and a couple points about the standard of review. On evidentiary issues, the standard is not abuse of discretion, as the respondents claim. On summary judgment, this court independently examines all the evidence, including the permit and the two offers to purchase. And with respect to ER 408, again, the trial court made that decision without any briefing. It came, frankly, out of nowhere, and there is no evidence, and the Grays offered none, that the permit was written to compromise any claim. It was 2 years before any dispute even kind of arose, and Teglin and other cases, you know, we cite, say that the dispute must be imminent. Also, the respondent said that they disputed silently the permit for many years, but an unexpressed dispute is not sufficient. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Dennis Jordan, and I represent the respondents Gray in this matter. First of all, I would point out that the trial court's decision in its own written decision, Judge Apple indicated that this issue regarding Riley had not been previously raised. In fact, having raised it on reconsideration, he then went back and reevaluated his opinion. But it's very clear that certainly he didn't feel it had been raised, and I did not feel it had been raised. And the real problem with not raising it in the gist of the motion itself is that there's no opportunity to build a record. Had that issue been raised during the proceedings of the motion for summary judgment, then I could have built a record that didn't depend entirely upon my client's testimony. I could have brought in other witnesses, but I didn't need to because the issue had never been raised.
Do you disagree with the analysis of Riley, though? Assuming we conclude that we have to deal with Riley one way or the other.
I think you've got to deal with Riley, and do I disagree with it?
Analysis, which says they get to ask questions about this whole idea of hostility over the period.
I don't think that's what Riley says, and I want to phrase what I think the question is to this court, and there are two questions, and they all involve what does Riley mean, and I'm going to read them to you because I wrote them down because I want to be very specific on what I think the questions are, and I think it may be a first impression question. And the question is, does Washington law require the denial of any summary judgment motion if important information lies solely in the possession of the moving party? That's one question. If Riley answers that question in the affirmative, then we don't have a lot of summary judgments that should be going to summary judgment, because if the information is solely within the mind of or the testimony of the moving party, then the summary judgment should be granted. Or is the question, is summary judgment to be not denied only if the moving party posits some admissible circumstantial evidence to rebut the moving party's evidence? And I think that's more likely the case here. If you look at Riley, in terms of the admissions that were made in Riley, the claiming party, the adverse possessor, prior to there being any dispute at all, made the statement, this is not our land. This land belongs to your landlord, or whatever, however it went. But it was
that would be direct evidence here, if I could characterize the appellant's evidence. They're saying that they have circumstantial evidence.
Well,
they have these two offers. They have the agreement. And I think the argument would be, to a prior fact, this is circumstantial evidence that they never truly treated this. Their control of this land is hostile to all of them.
All right, and that is the second question then here. The Riley case, as I say, because I don't think the Riley case answered the question that you've posed, but I'm pointing out to you that Riley really doesn't answer the question of circumstantial evidence. It answers the question of direct evidence. And whether I disagree with Riley or not is an opposite. But Riley had direct evidence. In our case, we do not have direct evidence. So the question is, what is the evidence that exists here? And I would point out to the court that you really need to look at this permit. First of all, I don't think offering to buy when Taper dies, there were two offers to purchase. When Taper died, there was an offer to his estate to purchase the entire property. That's not an admission of any kind. Creates any inference that the desire to purchase the whole of the property creates an inference that the possession that they've had as to a portion of the property wasn't hostile.
Let me just ask you, since the clock is running, with regard to the offer of settlement issue, do you agree with the trial court's analysis?
Yes, I do.
And you didn't really argue that.
No, I didn't argue it at the motion for summary judgment level, and the trial court discusses this in its opinion. I didn't argue it because Riley wasn't raised. If Riley had been raised, then I would have argued the offer and compromise or ER 408, but I didn't need to because the law was very clear that if you've already acquired title by adverse possession, that what you do after that doesn't impact the title you've acquired unless it's re-adversely possessed by the other party or unless you give a deed or do a formal conveyance that meets the statute of frauds. So it wasn't an issue I needed to address. And then when it came up on reconsideration, Because my response was late in getting to the court didn't consider my response, so the court did its own thing in terms of deciding, well, this was the question I raised of Jordan in the first place. He said he wasn't arguing that at that point, but I'm going to rely on it now because in a summary judgment proceeding, I can only consider admissible evidence anyway. So that was something the court did. I do agree with the court in terms of what it did. Now, let me tell you why. There are two reasons. First of all, I do feel it was an offer of compromise. And the reason for it is you need to look very specifically at the permit. The permit itself is prospective only. It only says that as of January 1, 2012, that Jerry Gray, agree that my possession of the property is permissive. Okay, well, that's a settlement in and of itself, because had that permit not been entered into, I can assume that what the record owners of the property would have done is to commence litigation because they wanted to stop the running of the statute of limitations. And so he enters into this thing and he says, only prospectively only am I saying that I am not, that my use is going to be permissive. He doesn't waive prior claim to the real estate. He doesn't disclaim a prior claim to the real estate. He doesn't do any, there's no language of conveyance in this. He doesn't even refer to the characterization of his prior use in this permit. So therefore, in my opinion, what this is this is a partial settlement in terms of moving forward. It is a, but it doesn't resolve, it's not a 100% settlement, because it doesn't resolve what the characterization of the use was prior to January 1 of 2012. It says nothing about that at all. And therefore,
it isn't signing it and saying it's permissive, inconsistent with, I don't need to acknowledge permission because I have a right to possess.
No, it is not at all, because the saying that I'm going to agree with you as to the future in terms of my use being permissive, where it doesn't characterize what the prior use was, is not inconsistent with what that use was. If he had said something in that said, I'm going to disclaim my prior use and I'm going to characterize my prior use to also be that, then yes, I would say it was inconsistent, but it's not.
Wouldn't there have to be some language in here that say the parties dispute, or something to the effect, the parties dispute the ownership of X, however, because we were neighbors and we want to get along, we agreed to do the following? I mean, wouldn't we have to have something at least that to sort of get into the realm of a partial settlement?
No, because the partial settlement is for the characterization of the property as you move forward. But there's no characterization of the property for historical characterization.
But that's an inference that's to be drawn, and this is summary judgment. Then don't we have to draw an inference against the moving party on this issue?
No, I don't think you do. And because what is the inference that you're going to be drawing from what he says about the future use of the property? You're then characterizing what you're drawing an inference as to what his past use was. But there's nothing in this document that gives rise to that kind of an inference. It's only as to future use. And if I've got a lawsuit that I'm going to be filing for adverse possession because I want to cut off the running of the statute of limitations, if I get an agreement from opposing counsel or from the party that says I'll agree that it's permissive, then I only have to worry about the historical use. Thank you, Your Honor. My time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honors. I have five quick points to make. As to the point about whether the permit was meant to compromise a dispute, the Blue case in 2016 might be instructive. In there, the language was much more clear with respect to what they intended to do with that boundary line adjustment. And again, here's there's no reservation of rights in the permit. There is no settlement language. Mr. Gray didn't say, you know, I don't really agree with this, but I'm going to sign it to keep the peace. There was no expressed dispute whatsoever. Putting aside for a minute ER 408 and Riley entirely, there's still a question of fact as to whether the fence was on the property line or not, and when it was moved. And Jerry Gray testified that he tried to keep that fence straight for some indeterminate period of time, but at some point, whether that was 1993 or 2008, we have no idea, that effort failed. And that question alone, that discrepancy alone, preclude summary judgment. There were two offers to purchase in 2011, and that's at CP 123, and 2013, and that's at CP 124 and 126. And why would anyone offer to pay money for property they already owned or signed a permit to use it if they already believed they owned it? And again, evidence can be... evidence
might be cheaper than litigation counsel.
Could be, but that's what they did. The evidence rules say that evidence can be direct or circumstantial, so circumstantial evidence is fine. And lastly, Riley isn't the only case that says that when the facts were solely in the possession of the moving party, that the case should go to trial. There's the Belize case, which is a Supreme Court case, the Arnold case, Court of Appeals, and the Brown case. This is well-settled law. Thank you so much.
Next up is the Emerald Hills.